Looks more like a party than a conference now, but at least for the next 2 hours, we still have to do some serious thinking. This session is called Information Freedom Rules after the title of the conference. And the title is a version of the title of a book by Hal Varian, Information Rules, which was published in 1999. Co-authored with Carl Shapiro on business strategies for the networked economy. And as Wizards of Oz tends to do, the idea has been updated with the notion that it's not information that's on itself as important as information freedom. So we'll see whether that's an idea that resonates with this panel. I'm Rishabh Ghosh, and I work at the University of Maastricht, and I spoke at the first Wizards of Oz, so it's really a great pleasure to be here, especially since what I'm talking about today, cooking pot markets, is something that I talked about at the first Wizards of Oz as well. And I'll be followed by Hal, and the final speaker will be Yochai Benkler, who's written a lot about the whole notion of peer production and social production, and recently published a book called The Wealth of Networks. What we're going to do is have the three talks one after the other with no questions in the middle, so if you really have any questions, you should remember them. And at the end, we'll have a debate where the three panelists will talk to each other and talk to you in the audience. We have 2 hours, but Volker tells me we can basically go on forever. So there is going to be a lot of time to have an exciting discussion. So with that, I'm going to start off with an update of what I spoke about 7 years ago in Wizards of Oz 1. So in Wizards of Oz 1 in 1999, I talked about cooking pot markets as a way of explaining the phenomenon of free software and other freely available goods on the internet. In 1999, most people thought that free software was a peculiar phenomenon, and certainly they did so in 1994 when I first started writing about this. People thought that free software developers and other people who did a lot of free stuff on the internet were altruists or were hobbyists or generally crazy in some way. I remember when I gave this talk back then, I also mentioned the word communist. But I didn't think, to me, it didn't seem reasonable that when you take people who are supposedly rational and self-interested according to economic theory and put them in front of a keyboard, they suddenly change. So a cooking pot market was my explanation for how I understood this to function. And how I understood it to be possible for people to have a rational, self-interested explanation for giving things away. In 2006, though, it's no longer thought of as a peculiar phenomenon. Practically any field of social sciences has several publications on free software, and there's a lot of research going on free software, free knowledge goods, Wikipedia, commons-based peer production, and all these sort of things, so much so that it's almost mainstream. And in fact, I think that's the idea of Wizards of Oz 4, to ask whether indeed information freedom is now mainstream. There has been a lot of business success as well, with almost all the major companies in the software industry supporting free software or open source software to some extent. Business strategies have worked around it. What's also interesting is that in 1999, cooking pot markets, which I will describe a bit further, was a hypothesis with anecdotal evidence. In 2006, there are lots of similar ideas, but they're now based on a lot of empirical evidence. I'll describe a very small amount of that. And mainstream economists no longer scoff at producing for free. Instead, they do it themselves, spending time on their blogs, as The Economist, the journal, described a couple of months ago. A lot of rational, self-interested economists are busy giving away a lot of their ideas, which they could either charge a lot for or publish in famous journals. They're giving that away for free. A reason for this is that a lot of people, economists included, have realized that when you give stuff away for free, it's not that other people are free riding and stealing your work. It's you do this only when you get value from what you're giving away. When the value that you get in return is more to you than the value that you're giving away. And one way of looking at this, which is how I've developed the idea of cooking pot markets further, is to look at what happens in any simple transaction. In the case of barter, where there's one guy who has fish and another guy who has potatoes, you have one transaction where fish are being exchanged for potatoes. This transaction only takes place when both sides feel that they benefit. To the person on the left, who's giving away fish and receiving potatoes, the value of the fish is less than the value of potatoes. To the person on the right, who's giving away potatoes and receiving fish, the value of the potatoes is less than the value of the fish. And that's why both are happy, both profit. When you buy something, it's pretty much the same thing. You, in effect, have two transactions. You have money being exchanged for potatoes and money being exchanged for fish. In this case, the person who's buying the fish values the fish more than the price of the fish, and the person who's buying the potatoes values the potatoes more than the price of potatoes. And it's the same thing when I buy a car. When I buy a car for 20,000 euro, the car is not worth 20,000 euro, though it's a convenience for economists to talk about it as if it was. In fact, the car is worth more than 20,000 euro to me, and it's worth less than 20,000 euro to the company that makes the car. Now, suppose you took away the transactions in the middle, and you put the hypothetical cooking pot, but it's easier for me to draw a cloud. So you have a fish going into the cooking pot cloud, and you have potatoes coming out of that. On the other side, you have fish coming out of the cloud and potatoes going in. To these people, the people who are transacting here, it doesn't make any difference whether there was a cloud in the middle or whether there was someone at the other end, because the same concept of profit is there for them. The person putting in the fish and getting the potatoes benefits or sees the value greater in the potatoes that he receives than the fish he gives, and similarly for the other end. Now, the reason that this idea was, I always said it was about a hypothetical tribal cooking pot, is that real tribes, as anthropologists would tell you, are not altruist in the economic sense. They never give away things for nothing. There is always instead this concept of reciprocity, where you're giving things away, but you know that you will get more back eventually. Sometimes that can be abused and can really bankrupt people. But in general, the principle is still consistent with self-interest. But you would always have the problem that you do have in barter, or you do have in a monetary transaction, that you need to weigh the things that are being transacted. So if it was a real cooking pot in a tribe, and I took my fish and you brought your potatoes and put them in, we would still have to figure out how many fish makes a potato or vice versa, because we then have to divide what's in the cooking pot. Which is why in real tribes, things don't really work that way. But on the internet, it's not real fish, it's digital fish. It's not real potatoes, it's digital potatoes. And when they are combined together in the cooking pot to add something of greater value, we don't have to divide what's in there. I get the whole cooking pot, and so do you. So in fact, what's happening is that a problem of the internet, what I called long ago the problem of infinity, which is that the internet can infinitely reproduce at very low marginal cost everything that's on it, which basically means that everything that's on it, an individual copy of anything that's on it, has no real value that you should be able to charge for. That's the problem of infinity, and that's what we are seeing throughout this conference, that you've got problems with pricing, that people don't recognize that piracy is wrong because it doesn't seem wrong. You've got these wonderful ad campaigns in the Netherlands and I think elsewhere in Europe, which have this, you know, gritty MTV-style photography and music about you don't steal a car, you don't steal this, you don't do that, but you download music. That's wrong. But it doesn't seem that way to anyone because, in fact, it isn't that way. But that's the problem of infinity, but it also comes with its own solution. Because, to me, it might cost something to produce one article. It does not cost anything to me to produce 10,000 articles because I don't do that. I write one article, and whether I have a million readers or two, it costs me the same to create that article. On the other hand, every single article out there that I read, each copy has no value, each additional copy has no value or no cost to the producer, but it adds value to me. So what I'm doing here is I'm putting my one fish into the cooking pot, and I'm getting the whole cooking pot back. So in fact, I'm getting more value out of it than I put in. And this is just slightly more detailed and more developed than what I said in 1999. But what we've done since then is a lot of surveys on free software in particular to try to get more into the empirical evidence behind this. Now, I'm not going to talk about free software today in detail because we've done a lot of stuff on that and I've talked a lot about that. And one of the things that we asked people in the FLOSS survey in 2001, 2002 was, why do you do what we do? And I know a lot of people say we do this for fun, but fun doesn't make any sense because fun is just a general sense of positive feeling. Fun doesn't explain why you do something rather than something else. You can say it's fun to do free software, but why do you do this project rather than that? Or why did you code that day rather than the other day? So when you start asking people in more detail, they come up with more detailed reasons. The only reason people say fun is because they don't think about it that much. And what was most interesting to me about this was when I gave this talk at the Linux Congress in Augsburg in 1999, shortly before Wizards of Oz, actually, which was one of the best conferences I've been to, because if you know the Linux Congress, it's where you have Linux kernel developers going there. Almost all the talks are technical, and I was giving a keynote on a completely non-technical subject. And unlike my audiences, even at the Wizards of Oz, where people have all sorts of funny questions they ask me, at the Linux Congress, everyone said, hey, that was perfect. That explains to us exactly what we do and why we do it. So when you take surveys of free software developers and ask them for things in more detail, you get all sorts of reasons, such as we do this because of ideology, or we do this because we want to get jobs. And in our surveys, what we found was the most commonly cited reason was we do this to learn and develop new skills, or we do this to share knowledge. But there's a whole complex of motivations, and the motivations are different for different people, and they're different in their importance. And they don't really, looking at the motivations in detail, don't really ask you, answer the one question that I wanted to answer for the sake of value flow and looking at this whole process of whether you get more than you give or you give more than you get. Well, we did a simple solution to that, which was to ask people. We asked them, looking at your participation with the community and with free software, do you contribute more than you get out of it, or do you get more than you give into it, or is the balance equal? And what's interesting was that, you can probably not see these things at all because I can't anyway, but the big blue thing is 71%, and that's, I take more than I give. Purple is I give as much as I take, and whatever this color is I give more than I take. So it's a very small percentage, about 11% of people who think that they're altruist. 11% of people really feel that they are giving more than they get. But 71% of people feel that they're getting more out of it than they give. This does not mean that they're doing it for selfish reasons. This does not mean that they could be getting more out of it. But what it does mean is that they could be selfish, they could be rational, they could be self-interested and still give their stuff away because they feel they're getting more out of it than they give. What's also interesting, and also what you might expect. When you're giving stuff into this cooking pot and you're getting so much more out of it, you assume that other people must be altruists, because surely other people are giving things away. They can't all be getting more than they give, because how could then everyone be happy? But in fact, we constructed this measure to see whether there was a Hobbesian view of the world. So we also asked people, do you think others get more than they give, or others give more than they get? And in fact, even there, the majority thought that others are selfish. Well, not a majority, but almost half thought that others are selfish. But there's still quite a big chunk, who think that others give more than they get. And that's quite natural, because when you see so much stuff out there that's of value to you, you don't realize that it's out there because it costs nothing to duplicate. You think a lot of it might be there because people are giving more than they get, but in fact that's not true. So that's quite interesting, and I think it confirms the possibility that people are acting rationally. And of course, when you look into the actual motives of why people do what they do, you get confirmation for that, because most of these motives can be clearly defined. The example of learning, for instance, we found in a later survey, is valid. It's not just that people imagine that they learn things from the free software community. They actually do. They learn a lot of technical skills, legal skills, management skills, and these skills are valued by employers. So much so that employers are willing to hire people who have no degrees but have worked and proven their experience in the free software community. This did vary across some countries in Europe, but it was quite a sustained finding, and we are currently doing a set of surveys around the world in another project to see whether the same is true in developing countries. If it is, it would be quite interesting. It means that you have this system of collaborative ownership and production, which not only is not exploiting people, which was another question I got from the audience in Wizards of Oz 1, are all these people giving their stuff for free? Aren't they being exploited? Well, not only are they not being exploited, not only do they think they're getting more out of it than they're giving, but they are in fact doing so. And what they're giving is of tremendous value. This is an estimation of the cost, the substitution cost of Debian GNU Linux. Debian, the reason we look at Debian is because Debian contains a lot of the free software code that's out there. It's not just Linux. It's a huge amount of free software code that's out there. Pretty much most applications that are of a certain production level of quality. And we calculate the estimation using standard models that are used in the software industry of how much it would cost roughly to create this within a software company. And this was estimated at 14,000 person years in 2001. And in 2005, it's grown a lot. And this is the substitution cost which firms don't actually have to pay, because they can get all this for free. So if they are spending a similar amount of money, they're in effect doing this for other things. And one of the studies we're doing right now is, this is how much it would cost for a firm to do all this in-house, but what has it actually cost in terms of time of developers in creating all this? Because we have to realize that despite the interest in businesses, with so much business going on, IDC released figures that there would be $18 billion worth of free software or Linux-related businesses in Europe alone in the next 2 years. Most of the code that's out there is written by individual authors, about 65%, and firms contribute about 15% of code, and other institutions contribute another 20%. So most of the output is still being done by the network of individuals, not by firms. So the concept of collaboration, the concept of creating things together, is as old as telling stories around a fireplace. What's new is not this form of collaboration. What's new is not the fact that people are creating things in a commons, because that's happened throughout history. That's happening even today in different fields, from whether it's Wikipedia, which is more high tech, to textile production in Ghana, to, earlier in history, to the common stories of Aborigines in Australia. What's new is the scale which allows you to take a fireplace in a village and transform that into a network around the world. And there's a book that I published last year, edited last year, which in fact has a chapter also by Yochai, called Collaborative Ownership and the Digital Economy, which tries to look at this from all these different perspectives, whether it's pharmaceuticals to textiles in Ghana to the history of European science and the academic community, to show that this form of collaboration is really not new. What's new is only the scale. And that's where I'd like to end my short contribution so that the others have a bit more time to speak. So if you have any questions, please keep them for the end of the talk. And we'll now have Halvarian, who will talk about... Halvarian is from the School of Information Sciences at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Information Rules. And he's going to talk about the update to Information Rules.
Okay, thank you very much for that nice introduction and excellent setting the stage for the rest of the evening. I want to talk about what went into writing information rules and maybe how I'd do it differently today. And I know it was said that that the book was published in 1999, but the truth of the matter is it was actually started in 1996. And I know that for a fact because I went through my email archives and we tried to find the very first email and the first written outline of the book, and it dates from September 2006. So this is the 10th anniversary of at least the conception of the book, if not the actual birth. There's a picture of the cover. So we started in September 1996. The final manuscript was submitted in March of 1998. It went out for sale. It was released on Amazon in October of 1998. And we were completely convinced that the internet boom had passed. We'd missed the boat. It was all over. And the book was a nice book, but it was just too late to really catch the wave. Well, next week it hit Amazon number one. It was a Business Week bestseller. And even now it still enjoys quite significant sales in business schools and economics departments. I think we found something good. And in fact, the timing couldn't have been better. We didn't miss the wave. We actually caught it at its best point, I think. Now, what I want to talk about today is what were our hits and what were our misses? So I'm going to talk about the hits first, and then I'll talk about the misses. So here are what I think we discussed in the book, went into in some detail, and turned out to be very, very important and very useful for understanding how the information economy works. And the first one was exactly what Rishad talked about a few minutes ago, the unique characteristics of information as an economic good. I'm going to say a few things about that in a second. Second thing was systems competition, which I think is still not fully appreciated. And, well, I'm not going to read the list because I'm going to talk about each of these items specifically in the next few minutes. And then, of course, I'll turn to the misses. So information is a good. Well, we just heard about it. On the supply side, you've got high fixed costs, very low marginal costs. It's expensive to produce, but cheap to reproduce. And so many of the problems of information in terms of the industry structure, in terms of the piracy issues, in terms of all of the things that we're talking about at this conference, stem from that supply-side economies of scale that we see with information. There's also an interesting effect on the demand side that doesn't receive quite as much attention, but I think it's very important, and that's the idea that information is an experience good. You don't really know what it is until you consume it. If you go buy a Coca-Cola, you know pretty much what you're getting because you've consumed Coca-Cola before. You buy a car, you buy a shirt, you know what the product is. But with information, every time you consume it, it's new. If you knew exactly what it was, it wouldn't really be information. So you've got a whole elaborate structure that's set up there to try to describe goods, to preview goods, to give out samples, to show you what things are, to induce you to buy the product that isn't necessarily needed for ordinary sorts of goods. An example we used in the book in discussing this fixed cost, marginal cost distinction was Britannica versus Encarta. And now, of course, the updated, it would be obvious you'd talk about Wikipedia versus both, because 10 years ago, it was quite remarkable that Encarta, which was a supermarket encyclopedia, what was the original, Funk and Wagnalls was the original encyclopedia on which Encarta was based, and here it had destroyed virtually Britannica, which was a 200-year-old institution, and now I would say both products are being eclipsed and have been eclipsed by the Wikipedia. So that would be the updated version, a story that everyone here is familiar with. The next topic that I think is a critical issue is systems competition. That's an issue where the value to the user depends on the entire system. A DVD player plus the DVD discs. Hardware plus software. You've got to have two components or multiple components to have a useful system, and the components can be made by completely different industries with completely different economic structures. So in high-tech economics, the interaction that you have to worry about is not just with your suppliers and not just with your consumers, but also with your complementers. Your complementers, that is, the companies that provide complementary products to the product that you were selling or, in some cases, giving away. So then, of course, the example was Wintel. You had Intel and you had Microsoft, and they were both producing a product that was useless without the other product. And now I think the example that would be the most interesting probably is Google and the telecommunication companies, the net neutrality debate that we'll probably hear some more about tomorrow evening. This brings up a lot of interesting questions with respect to antitrust, with respect to regulation, with respect to business strategy, with respect to consumer welfare, and so on and so on and so on. Next topic we talked about in great detail was differentiation of products and prices. The idea there was you can create a product line of information goods. Information, it's, you know, when you think of a book, you say, well, here's the book. But you forget that the book can be available at the bookstore, from the library, by borrowing from a friend, in hardback, in paperback, online, many different versions. And we talked about that in some detail. If you have the rights to some piece of information, you shouldn't think of producing in just one form, but think of it producing in a variety of forms so you can reach the broadest possible audience. And now what happens if you go to buy a DVD, you'll often find there's a standard version for rental or for the ordinary consumer, and then there'll be a collector's edition or a special edition with extra features, extra outtakes, and other things because they're trying to sell into both of those markets. If you look at Wi-Fi access, a lot of the free Wi-Fi access that you're seeing in the U.S. cities is a tiered structure. You have a low bandwidth for free and then a higher bandwidth for $19.95 a month or some higher price, because they're using the profit from the higher-end users to cross-subsidize those low-end users. And at the same time, they're pulling the low-end users in with the low price, hoping to upsell them to the higher-end service. And again, net neutrality becomes in because the debate, which I think is a healthy debate, is whether it's whether you want to have this kind of tiered access for a basic internet service. Now, one of the things I will say is we didn't see quite as much of this as we expected, in part because of the missing micropayment infrastructure. 10 years ago, when people were talking about commerce on the internet, they were thinking there would be a payment system, not just credit cards, but a way to do small payments, 50-cent payments, $1 payments, and you could have much more paid-for information. Turns out there no such infrastructure is really developed. There's a few contenders to this. Part of the reason it never developed, I think, is because nobody wanted to cede power to any private sector company that can control a payment system on the internet. And instead, we've seen the emergence of advertising as an alternate model. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in a few minutes. We talked about rights management and copyright, where the maxim that we pushed at that time, which I think has become commonplace today, is you should maximize the value of your internet of your intellectual property, don't necessarily maximize protection. There was a lot of paranoia at the time, and it was commonplace to see newspapers tiptoeing onto the web, and you'd read an article from the newspaper, at the bottom would say, all rights reserved, do not reproduce, do not circulate. Well, nowadays, what do you see at the bottom of every article? It says, click here to email it to a friend, because they've learned that it's much more valuable to get the widespread circulation of the content, even privately owned, copyrighted, profit, content that where they're trying to maximize the profit. It's more profitable to have it distributed than to have it locked down. And in part also, that's because of the prevalence of the advertising model versus the payment model, because of course, if you're looking at an article on the web and you send it to your friend, well, your friend not only sees the article, but of course, all the advertisements as well. So it's natural that you would try to maximize distribution in an advertiser-supported model as opposed to a payment-supported model. We talked about lock-in and switching cost. Lock-in, this is a situation where there's many choices for the initial purchase, but then it's costly to switch after adoption. Well, our prime example was Microsoft or the choice of an operating system, and I think that would have to still be the choice that we'd use as the prime example. Once you bought into the Microsoft model, it's very, very hard to move away, and one of the great appeals of open source software is, of course, the reduction in switching costs, because you maintain your flexibility, even if it's more costly. Even if it happened to be more costly to use open source software, it would still be advantageous because it changes the bargaining position with respect to future developments. So people understand this problem all too well. Nobody wants to get locked in. Nobody wants to enable the next Microsoft. And it's been very, very hard for businesses who are trying to count on lock-in and switching costs as part of their business model because everybody's aware of the issue. So people are suitably warned about the difficulties from lock-in, and it's not been as big a force as one might have thought precisely because of that warning that we offered, and I think that other people offered as well. And if you look at the businesses that are the brand name businesses on the internet today, Amazon, Google, Yahoo, they all have very, very low switching costs. You don't have to buy at Amazon. You can go to your local store. You can go to buy.com. You can go to hundreds of vendors on the internet. You don't have to use Google. You can use Yahoo. And the switching costs, the competition is just a click away. So these companies have primarily had to compete on the quality of the service and the quality of product that they offer. Now, I think it's rather different with the other big success story, which is eBay, because eBay has benefited from another topic we discussed in detail, and that's network effects. So the idea with network effects is that the value of adopting a product to a user depends on the number of other adopters. Our prime example in the book was, of course, Microsoft. If you, back then, there had just been another operating systems war between Microsoft and IBM with OS2 versus Microsoft, and before that, there was a battle between DOS and the Macintosh operating system. So it was natural to use that as our illustration. But I think eBay is the prime illustration we'd use today because buyers, of course, want to be where there's a lot of sellers because it puts them in a driver's seat. Sellers want to be where there's a lot of buyers. So once you establish a base of having a very thick market, a big market, then it's very, very difficult for any single player, any single buyer or seller to switch. So that gives eBay a big, big entry barrier. It's very, very difficult to compete against eBay, at least in any given country. In Japan, the first mover, or the most successful mover, I should say, in the person-to-person auction market was actually Yahoo, so eBay is pretty much given up in that country. I'm not sure what the situation in Germany is. Is eBay the strongest? Yeah. So it's going to depend on country-to-country basis, but I think network effects are also something that we popularized or really made people aware of in that book 8 years ago. And that relates closely to the idea of standards wars, the value of controlling a standard. Microsoft versus Netscape, that was a topic of discussion. 56 kilobit modems, seems laughably slow in today's world. The CD standard, DVDs, beta versus VHS, all of those are old hat. Nowadays, I think the story in standards is Qualcomm and CDMA versus GSM, third generation wireless. And we're seeing a very, very interesting standards battle now play out on high definition DVD or next generation DVD between Sony and everyone else. The strategy we talked about 8 years ago are being used very, very heavily in that particular standards battle. Preemption, trying to release your product before the other guy, even if it's a little buggy or not working quite so well. If you can get it out and build your user base, you have an advantage. You build an alliance, both in that case on the hardware side, because it's a systems competition issue. And of course, there's expectations management where you're trying to convince potential adopters that you're going to be the winner of this standards war. And again, standards have become highly politicized. If you look at the situation on the Internet Engineering Task Force 10 years ago, it's nothing like the situation now. 10 years ago, it was basically a few crazy guys from research laboratories and universities. And now every major company that's involved with the Internet has its own agenda, and it's become a much more difficult environment than it used to be back in the good old days. And finally, the last thing we talked about in some detail was antitrust. And the reason is that monopolies are almost inevitable in industries where you have network effects, where you have switching costs, where you have systems competition, where you have standards, which are drivers for providing information, sort of an infrastructure. The Microsoft case has been resolved in the United States. It's still alive and kicking in Europe, as you're well aware. And the basic issue, I think, is going to be with us for at least another decade, and that is what kind of tactics are allowable in terms of extending a monopoly. So the next phase of this antitrust battle, I think, is going to come up with the search box wars, because Internet Explorer 7 is just being released. Vista will be out in a few months, and Microsoft is taking a very concerted effort to try to direct users towards their own search engine as opposed to giving them a choice among alternatives, or at least an easy choice. The choice is there, it's just buried three or four menus down, and we're going to see some interesting legal cases there in terms of what tactics can you use in terms of extending an existing monopoly that may be obtained by perfectly legal methods. That is, it's a monopoly is not illegal, it's the maintenance of monopoly, the extension of monopoly that can be illegal under certain circumstances, and that really has yet to be clarified, I think, in both U.S. and European courts. What do we miss? I've been bragging about all the things we hit, but I think there are at least four things we missed, and maybe I'll hear about more later this evening. One thing we missed was auctions. We didn't talk much about auctions. We didn't talk much about advertising, and that's become a dominant business model for information content on the Internet. We didn't talk about peer production, and we'll hear about that in a few minutes. And we didn't really talk very much about patent strategy. Now, auctions are thriving. I've already mentioned eBay. That's been a huge success. Google and Yahoo, their underlying business model was based on this advertising auction. All those little ads that you see on the right-hand side of the page on Google, their placement is determined by advertisers bidding for position. And there are literally billions of auctions being held every week on Google to place those ads on the right-hand side of the page. They're also thriving in academia. Back in 1993, 94, I wrote a paper on mechanism design for computerized agents, where I argued that a lot of the ideas of economics and designing incentive-compatible mechanisms and other systems to try to allocate resources in a distributed environment were applicable on internet and computerized environments. And nowadays, this topic's become known as algorithmic game theory. And according to a number of my colleagues in computer science, it's one of the most exciting and most interesting areas in theoretical and, I would say, applied computer science. Now, here, actually, we did have a chapter. I wrote a chapter on auctions because I thought it was exciting to see how those would play out on the internet, but we dropped it because there really weren't compelling examples. So in some sense, we may have missed the boat here, but we were ahead of the boat. It's just that it took a while to catch up. I went back and looked at that chapter and preparing for this, and it's had some good ideas. If we ever do a second edition of Information Rules, we'll try to add that back in. Search and advertising. We mentioned search, the value of search, the value of keywords, personalization, customization. As was all mentioned in Chapter 1, we gave some examples of keyword pricing, and I think clearly alluded to the potential for advertising the internet, but after that we didn't really mention in the book, again, because there weren't really compelling examples. Search, which has been a hugely successful business model in the internet, doesn't quite fit the model that we laid out in Information Rules. There's minimal lock-in, as I mentioned earlier. It's very easy to switch to another search engine. There's very minimal network effects. There's not a strong network effect at all. Just because I use a particular search engine doesn't mean anything with respect to your adoption. And it's very hard to differentiate the product. In fact, I had experts in the search business come in and tell me there's no market there. It's completely commoditized. Anybody can write a search engine. There's nothing to differentiate any search engine from any other search engine. And it's just totally uninteresting from an economic point of view. Well, of course, they were completely wrong. If you have a good idea and you build a better mousetrap in your basement, people will buy it, and that's really what's happened with Google in particular. There is a significant supply-side economies of scale because just managing the huge infrastructure that you need to provide service around the world, around the clock, with high performance, that's a very difficult challenge from both an engineering and a managerial side, so there are economies of scale. And I would be surprised if we saw new entrants in the search business simply because of that classical supply-side economy of scale. And it's pretty hard to compete at this point given the current environment. I could be wrong, but that's my guess. And, of course, the other side is having that advertiser and publisher base. Once you have hundreds of thousands of advertisers, then you can leverage that to do other sorts of business opportunities. And finally, I turn to peer production, which is the major topic of this conference. I think it's historically unprecedented. I gather Larry is going to talk about this a little more. We already heard last night about freedom of the press goes to those who own one. And nowadays, it's true that pretty much everybody owns one, that everybody has this potential freedom of the press because of access to an audience, at least potential access. Getting people to read what you write can be difficult, but at least you could put it in front of them. We've had all this development of open source, blogs, photos, video, Wikipedias, and I think it's true that we underestimated the impact. It's a little ironic because we wrote the book actually using LaTeX. So an open source product. We didn't use Microsoft Word. We didn't use a proprietary product. We used LaTeX. And part of the reason for doing that was because we could interchange files very easily, and it's still completely stable. In fact, I've actually written most of my books in tech, and I can go out and tech the original manuscript of books that were written in 1986, and it still works perfectly, which is a wonderful thing. You can't do that with Microsoft Word or any other proprietary software that I know of. I think also at that time, Microsoft dominated the book in many ways because we're talking about the lock-in, the switching costs, the standards, the network effects, and Microsoft came up over and over again. And I believe we underestimated the effect to which open source has really competed with Microsoft, particularly on the server side and embedded applications. That time, I think they were the 300-pound gorilla, and it wasn't clear where competition would come from at all. But now I think it's quite true that there is effective competition, at least in some of the dimensions. Blogs, again, at that time, we thought of micropayments as the primary economic model for how content would be distributed, and that turned out to be completely wrong. Part of the reason is because, most recently, Google has provided the AdSense model, which provides a very simple, cost-effective way for small businesses to acquire advertisers, doing this kind of two-sided matching. They provided a business model for cost recovery in that kind of content. And of course, we've heard about Wikipedia many times. I think the jury's still out on Wikipedia in one sense. I think it's been a phenomenally successful product, phenomenally successful movement, I should say. But I think there is a danger there of trying to avoid commercialization. And again, if you have a long memory, you can think back to the Open Directory Project, which is a way to get around Yahoo and provide an open directory structure that anybody could contribute to. And that was very much in the news for a while, and now it's pretty much completely disappeared because it became basically excessively commercialized and dominated by interests. So wasn't really very useful. And I think that's the threat that the Wikipedia is going to have to face, although I think it could be overcome. I'm just saying that that's the problem that I see developing in the future. So today, my view, I would say the big issues from the economic side are still antitrust and regulation. What are the rules of the game? Net neutrality has come up in the last year. The old name for net neutrality was common carriage. It was a standard debate in the telecommunications world. 10 years ago, in fact, in 1996, was when the U.S. passed its major telecommunications deregulation bill. And we still don't really know just how successful telecommunications can be as a competitive industry. In some places, it seems to have worked reasonably well. In other places, it hasn't. It's still, I think, quite difficult to design a set of rules and a set of regulatory environment that's really going to be effective in that kind of networked industry. And finally, the last topic, which I think is an issue and will remain an issue for decades to come, is the intellectual property issue. Right now, I think there's a number of interesting legal cases, the right to build directories, where I think of the Google Library Project as a prime example. Even if you say, here's all this proprietary content out there, whether it's photos or movies or books or whatever it is, the question is, can I build a directory to it to allow people to access it? Is that a derivative work in the legal sense? I would say no, but there are those that disagree. And I think the issue of how to build directories to access content is going to be a live issue for many years. And the problem of orphan works, where one of the ridiculous problems in copyright is even when you want to license a copyrighted material, it can be extremely difficult to identify the actual rights holder, to negotiate the terms, and to actually arrange a transaction. It's ridiculous now, totally obsolete from a technological point of view. And I think there's a lot of interesting challenges in trying to build a better environment for matching up buyers and sellers in that kind of world. And finally, patent policy, where the challenge today is in improving patent quality. I like to think of patents as having a length, a width, and a height. That is, a length is a term, the width is the breadth of coverage, the height is the standard of novelty. And the United States in particular has adopted an exceedingly low standard of novelty. There's a lot of junk patents out there. Everybody knows it. And interestingly enough, the battle lines in that particular battle are not the industry giants like Microsoft. Microsoft is actually on the side of the angels in that particular war. The battle is between the information technology industry and the biotech industry, where most of the big players in information technology would rather see a much higher standard for patents, whereas most of the players in the biotech industry would say, no, no, keep things the way they are. This is the business model we know and love. Don't change the patent law. So we're seeing a lot of debate in Congress, a lot of lobbying, not so much between the big companies and the small companies, but between the information technology industry and the biotech industry. So that's my story on information rules. Even after 10 years, I think there's a lot of relevant material in the book, but luckily we didn't exhaust the subject. There's a lot more to say, and I think we'll hear some more in our next talk. So thank you.
Thank you, Harry. And once again, we'll keep questions for the end, and the next speaker will be Yochai Benkler from Yale Law School. We'll talk about peer production, which was one of the aspects of information freedom that, as Hal said, was not in his book.
Okay. Thanks for the introduction, and I'm thrilled to be here at Wizard of Oz 4. I want to spend the next 30 minutes talking about the economics of peer production and social production and the politics. And let's start with the economics. To understand what's happening, one has to go back 150 years. Between 1835 and 1850 in the United States, the cost of starting what was understood as a mass circulation newspaper rose from roughly the equivalent of $10,000 in 2005 terms to roughly the equivalent of $2.5 million. The difference between $10,000 and $2.5 million is that you need a business plan for the latter, but there are many diverse ways of deciding to do the former. What happened was that around the cost of electric presses and the professional commercial organization of media, we saw a stark bifurcation between producers and consumers, with passive large audiences and professional commercial producers. And only two basic models were available for amassing the financial capital necessary to have the physical capital to communicate with the ever-expanding markets and societies that were coming together in the industrial economy. And those were either markets or governments. This gets replicated in radio, in television, in mainframes, in satellites, and characterizes information production, or at least its core, for the next 150 years. Here's another image. In the middle of 2002, a shudder came through American backs as the fastest supercomputer in the world was no longer American-produced, but was produced by the NEC, by NEC as the Earth simulator. 2 years later, a sigh of relief as IBM produces Gene Blue and just edges out NEC Earth simulator, while throughout this entire period, 4.5 million users around the world using their leftover computer cycles while they're running their screensavers have created SETI at home, process with tremendous processing power, processing information from NASA's SETI program. What's happened in the last couple of years since then is that IBM has caught up, SETI at home has grown, there are a few more Gene Blues, but now there's also Einstein at home, and if you look at the top 500 supercomputers and compare them to the top distributed computing platforms, this, by the way, is the level at which everyone was 2 years ago, you see a steady presence of distributed computation playing a parallel role. Why does this matter? It matters as an image with which to capture the core change in the networked information economy, the radical decentralization of physical capital. Computation, storage, and communications capacity are now in the hands of every connected person, which is somewhere between 600 million and a billion people around the planet, who have the physical capital necessary to communicate and create and exchange information, knowledge, and culture. We find ourselves in a new situation where the most important inputs into the core economic activities of the most advanced economies are widely distributed in the population. And this means what we've already talked about, communications and computation resources, but also, no less important, human creativity, intuition, experience, and motivation, which are non-fungible and individual and unique, but are held at the edges in individuals as human beings. The result has been that behaviors that have always been there, but on the periphery, social exchanges, cooperation, friendships, decency, everything from answering a stranger who stops you on the streets and say, how do I get to so-and-so? And you answer to relationships with family, move from being socially important to also being at the core of the most advanced economies in the world. So let's talk a little bit about concepts. The first is commons-based production, which means production without exclusion, without using property to exclude people from the inputs into innovation or from the outputs of the process. It doesn't yet mean cooperation. It can be individual or collaborative. It doesn't mean non-commercial. It can be commercial or non-commercial. The critical point here is that no one has authority to exclude anyone else from action. And we'll see in a few minutes why that matters in terms of why this process is creative. The other concept is peer production, by which I mean large-scale cooperation among human contributors that is not dependent on price signals or on managerial commands. Often people bring up alternatives. Well, you use a little bit of this. This is an ideal type, just like the market is an ideal type and the firm is an ideal type. Inside the firm, you can have markets through compensation. Inside the market, you can have some management. The ideal type of peer production is large-scale cooperation that depends more on social signals and communications, not on price signals or commands. We're also seeing a lot of sharing of material resources. And the details of the economics here are different because when you see something like SETI at home or you see something like wireless network, mesh networks, distributed storage like P2P networks or mixtures, these things are shareable goods, but they're not public goods like information. They're not non-rival, as Hal and Rishabh had mentioned before. But that's less important for my purposes than the fact that you have shareable goods that have characteristics that make them amenable to the same set of social productive relations, not necessarily on price signals and command, like all of these examples. And they characterize computation, communications, and storage, the three critical physical inputs. So I won't be the one, obviously, to talk here about free or open source software. There are more than enough people to talk about that here. What I want to emphasize is this kind of an image that I think really has played an enormously important role in the social understanding of free software, which is to say it works. This is the market share of Apache in servers connected to the web for over a decade through boom and bust. When you present this and you see that the mission critical application of web servers is adopted widely, systematically over time, you have existence proof, you have success, you have experience already with integration into markets, you have a story that people need to pay attention to. Another story that has moved from a quirky thing that nobody knew about to something that's an existence-proof story is Wikipedia. Now, there are all the arguments, is Wikipedia really being, is it really at the same quality as Britannica or not? Is it perfectly accurate? When do you do it? All of these things are marginal skirmishes at the edges. Because if in 2001, when Jimmy Wales put a few stubs on the net with an infrastructure that allowed anyone to edit anything, you would say in 5 years, this would be an encyclopedia that nature would seriously say is every bit as crappy as Britannica on science. No one would believe you. So it doesn't matter whether it's as good or not. It matters that it's arguably as good or not. And this is what I want to continue to talk about, which is to say not free software as free software, but free software and Wikipedia as a basis for a new mode of production of information, knowledge, and culture of all forms in the networked information economy. Be it news, this might be Slashdot, as well as accreditation, be it images, be it relevance, like in Delicious, be it cultural production, or even just sites that where people share their anime movie. We're seeing peer production, and we're seeing commons-based production, both individual and collaborative, happen everywhere on the net, filling every niche of cultural exchange. Essentially, we could say the following. When capital costs were high, we had different forms of centralized production, firms and governments or traditional nonprofits that could raise large amounts of capital. Or we could have decentralized production, but that had to be in the market system, largely, in the price system. What we're seeing now with the decentralization of capital is the emergence alongside of social sharing exchange as a decentralized non-market force, playing together with decentralized market forces that themselves don't operate in the price system, but in the commons-based system. What characterizes commons-based peer production is radically decentralized authority and practical capability to act. When I talked about the technological shock, it was about the practical capability to act. People couldn't get together on the weekend with friends and build a mass production car. They still can't. People couldn't get together on the weekend with their friends and create a mass circulation newspaper. They can. That's the change in practical capability. The commons aspect is to match the location of the authority with the location of the capacity to act. You no longer need to ask for permission when you're operating in a commons-based system. May I act? But rather, you say, I can do something with this. And that is the critical change. Because a major problem in industrial organization has been that knowledge production is incontractable. It's very hard to contract, very hard to figure out what it means to be creative, where knowledge is, who knows, how much know-how they have or haven't produced. And we've seen all sorts of theories and internal practices within firms trying to improve, be it the networked organization, team production and Toyotism, efforts of various knowledge management interfirm solutions. Peer production solves this problem by allowing self-selection. You tap diverse motivations, particularly intrinsic motivations about what I care about and social relational, that don't require the precise definition, you do this and you do that or you'll be compensated in the other way, and taps diverse insights, capability, availability, and attention. You could imagine that the old problem of knowledge management in a firm was where company A had to figure out that it even owned resources R1 and R4 and that it employed an agent, A2, that actually knew something useful to do. The idea of finding that there's an A8 working somewhere else that could do even better with these resources was entirely beyond the capacity. What we see with peer production systems, and of course this is as though everyone in a circle, but really they're in a network, is that through self-selection, someone can say, I know what to do with those things, and because of the distribution of physical capital necessary and the management of the resources under a common system, they have the capacity and the authority to act, and therefore they can, and they do, and the best person works on the best set of resources, at least in the best case scenario. Now, doing this is not trivial. And originally I talked about the necessity of modularity, granularity, and an integration platform when I wrote Coase's Penguin several years ago. I think basically what we're seeing when we look at this, and this is a lot of what I'm doing now since I've finished the book that's the basis of this talk, is to begin to look at the diverse cooperation platforms that are necessary, both technical and organizational, to allow people to cooperate when you no longer are operating in a standard system of command or price. We see task construction, major question of how you reduce the cost of action. And this is where modularity, modularizing the problem so that it's small enough and chunky enough that people can work independently, providing small grain and variable granularity of projects so that people who want to invest a huge amount can, people who just want to contribute 5 minutes can, and tapping all of those diverse people and motivations. But we also have to manage the ability to self-select, communication. Humanization turns out to be important in cooperation as we look at the theoretical and empirical literature on cooperation. Trust construction, norm creation, these are all central to the success of Wikipedia, as well as transparency. Not everybody who contributes knows what they're doing, as it turns out. Not everybody who contributes or who intervenes necessarily wants to contribute. Mechanisms for monitoring and peer review and discipline are necessary. A sense of fairness is central to who participates and what it is that they get out of it and how they participate. All of these then intersect once you actually move, and this is Hal's point about the market. Once you actually interface with a market system, you have to deal with crowding out, with the problem that when you bring in money for some, not for all, or at all for anyone, you affect self-selection, you affect norm creation, trust construction, fairness. It requires reconstruction. It's not impossible. We've seen it happen in free software, so we know it can be done. But that's a core issue for study now, is how we design these systems as stable systems for human cooperation and how we deal with the interface with markets. What we've seen as a market and social phenomenon is that peer production has become a new source of competition for the industrial information economy incumbents, be it peer-to-peer networks to the recording industry, free software to Microsoft, Wikipedia to the commercial encyclopedias, Skype to telecommunications, but also, and in a sense more importantly, a source of new opportunities as firms begin to think of themselves less as producing well-behaved appliances and more producing production tools, less bifurcating from consumer and infrastructure goods as completely different things to dual-use machines and soft infrastructure like Wi-Fi and Skype, to finished information, from producing finished information goods to passive consumers, to providing platforms for self-expression and collaboration, like GarageBand for music or Technorati for identifying blogs and the whole Web 2.0 capability. We've seen enormous importance to the model of surfers, which is bizarre when you talk about it. Stuff will flow out of connected human beings, and I will rely on that to contract with someone else and say, I promise to deliver on day X this product because I will build on stuff that flows out of connected human beings. And I'll pay people to participate in that, and I'll let them use my patents. Crazy. Until you look at IBM's revenues, this is the largest patent holder in the United States. The green is their licensing revenue. Their blue is Linux-related services revenue. It becomes a lot less crazy. And again, I want to emphasize it's not just software. The BBC found, when London was rocked on by terror, that the only images from inside were from mobile phones. Well, they learned. Now, help us make the news. Invitation. What do you have that we can use? Be part of making the news. Skype. It's a pretty good deal when you can compete in a global voice over IP network when you provide the servers and everybody else using a peer-to-peer architecture brings their own infrastructure. That's very cool. You can actually build a lot of things. If you just look at this company that was mentioned a couple of times and how it is playing with a variety of mechanisms of peer production, ranging from the very decision of what is accredited, PageRank, who is the site that most other people who bother to have a website point to the GNU Linux services servers, to the use of Wi-Fi in the proposed wireless and the shared spectrum, to user-generated content from Blogger, from the annotated maps, from Google Video, Google Groups, from the consumer ratings of Frugal, to the use of the Open Directory Project outputs and the efforts to co-op. What we're seeing here is if people talk about the emergence of the networked firm and the nodal firm as creating contractual relations with suppliers and customers, what we're seeing is the emergence of a capability in firms to be a node in a network that permeates the boundaries of the firm, but also the boundaries of just market actors as being producers and consumers, users in a network that both provides platforms for them, but also builds on their outputs. So social production is a real fact, not a fad. It's the critical long-term shift caused by the internet. In some contexts, it's more efficient than markets and firms. It's sustainable and growing fast as a source of new competition, as a new solution set and opportunity space. But it's a threat to and threatened by incumbent business models. What we see today in intellectual property and telecommunications, a variety of other new and funky laws, is an effort to combat the design of the legal environment so as to affect the outcomes of the competition in the market between the incumbents of the industrial information economy and the emerging network information economy. Which brings me to politics. Why should we care? We should care because I think if we look at it carefully, we'll see that peer production improves, not utopia, but improves along the dimensions of individual autonomy, of democracy, and even of justice and development. Autonomy. People can do things they couldn't do before. If you look for Viking ships on Google, this will be one of the sites. I've used it for 5 years now as an example. It's still one of the first sites. It's produced by a single teacher in a classroom, a fifth grade classroom in Gander, Newfoundland. Would have been impossible to create a worldwide teaching tool for someone like that. Now it's possible. Or somebody can collaborate with others to do something that they had always dreamed to do, like Project Gutenberg, to do things. We have new practical capabilities to do more for and by ourselves, as well as in loose cooperation with others. When we look at democracy, people talk about electronic voting, this, that, the other. This is a story about electronic voting, but what matters are not the machines. What matters are the people and the construction of the public sphere. Diebold are voting machines. As you'll remember, the U.S. had a bit of an issue with voting in 2000. And so people started to introduce electronic voting machines. There was almost no reporting in the mass media, and certainly none critical or investigatory. And yet one activist found the source code from an FTP site, posted it on a website as well as in the US as well as in New Zealand. Part of the posting helps us understand how the public sphere now is constructed. First of all, see for yourself, here's the source code. Not trust me, I'm the New York Times, I'm telling you what's in it. Second, people will try to censor this. Make copies so they can't shut it down. Not I'll go and get an injunction with a fancy lawyer. Some of these things may be password protected. Here are these nice people in lostpasswords.com. They'll help you. Some of these things might be corrupted. Here are these nice people at ZipRepair. And we don't have any money to pay anybody to do the research. We know it's hard, but, you know, it's important. If you find anything out, let us know here. What ends up happening is that, in fact, the source code is investigated. Maryland eventually says, oh, my goodness, this report is serious, continues to report, and requires changes. The same person becomes a node. And when email become available, becomes the a source for them. When it's reported on Wired, it's just, can you believe they lost it again, but no further change. But here again, it's out. Now, Diebold issues a DMCA letter, a Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and says, it's ours, these emails are ours, they're copyrighted, you can't use them. But already students have replicated it. Well, Diebold knows what to do. Send another letter to the college. Shut off the students, right? Wrong. Wrong because at that point, a network of individuals and organizations, of legal practices and illegal practices, of free software and commercial software, proprietary software, all intersect to make the information irrepressible. Then people search the emails. They find, for example, that there are issues with the California machines, and those machines, many of the machines, get decertified in California. They win in court that this is an outrageous use of copyright, but they win a year later when it would have been too late. The effect was one where people collaborated using what they had to research the problem, to replicate the data, to communicate it, to publish it, and ultimately to act on it. So it's not the utopia of the 1990s, and people talked, but it's not everyone a pamphleteer. But we're also not also intellectual lemmings jumping over and not listening to anyone. We have a decent empirical evidence now, at least from link practices of what happens. We see a structured web that offers more visibility to more people in accreditation and filtration clusters, relatively free of the financing constraints of speech, and critically important, emphasizing what is intensely interesting to active users who link to each other and are embedded, as opposed to in the mass media environment, just something that can capture the dull semi-attention of millions of people. We see strong linking practices here. See what the other person has said, even across political divides. We see a strong see-for-yourself ethic. We see it easier for people to form purposive association. We're going to do this, let's do that, let's negotiate how we'll do it. And it's global as well as local. At the broader level of abstraction, the culture we occupy is also part of the political public sphere at a much more basic level. The way in which we tell stories about how our lives are and how they could become. Here we're beginning to see both plasticity and transparency play roles. Plasticity allows for remix culture. We could think of it as a reemergence of a new form of folk culture based on active participation and storytelling as opposed to passive consumption of finished goods. We also see greater transparency as people actually see how things are done, as people become more active creators themselves, they become more critical readers. Every intervention becomes more provisional, more critical, more potentially self-reflective when you are not a couch potato taking the authority of a finished good, but are yourself a creator in conversation with other creators. And finally, I want to say 10 words roughly, well, a little more, about justice. The critical point here is that more of what makes for human welfare and development depends on information, knowledge, and culture today. If you just take the components of the Human Development Index, health and life expectancy, education and literacy, and GDP per capita or growth, each and every one of them is dependent on information, knowledge, or culture. Research and the research outputs and knowledge-embedded goods for food security, medicines, research and journals, and outcomes data for public health, books and teaching materials, computation, communications, libraries and academic centers and journals for education. And we know that innovation is absolutely central to growth. What we're beginning to see, and I'm a little less certain about this is more instrumental and provisional, is commons-based and peer production beginning to help in some areas more, in some areas less, with free and open source software in use by governments and in use in the One Laptop Per Child initiative and efforts to deliver open academic publishing and open content, learning materials, efforts to take this model of solving and convert them to basic questions of food security, like open source agricultural innovation in the BIOS initiative, bioinformatics, the HapMap project, even maybe open source biomedical innovation. So these are not perfect. But here's an effort at an open source free high school science text in South Africa. They've got a physics textbook. They're working on math and chemistry. Here's the International HapMap project showing the early stages of biological computation. Here's BIOS, the effort of the Biological Information Surveillance Society. And here is even somebody trying to build kits that could be sent to undergraduate classes in chemistry so they synthesize the targets that come out of computational biology for intervention in poor country diseases. But don't forget the threat. And the threat is leading to a battle over the institutional ecology of the digital environment. We're seeing it occur at every single layer. At the transport with the broadband duopoly and the question of net neutrality on one side and the efforts to regulate net neutrality, but more importantly, to create open wireless networks by using the shareability of spectrum to build an alternative, as well as municipal broadband. We see the efforts to regulate the general purpose PC so that it becomes a well-behaved appliance, what's sometimes called trusted systems, systems that are trusted against their owners. But we see, on the other hand, the push of the market demand for general purpose devices. We see software patents and proprietary standards and the desktop monopoly, but we see free and open source software, and no less important, the increasing business acceptance of the value of open source and open standards and free software. And it goes on. and we see the extended degree to which, in law, the industrial information economy players are winning. As rights in copyright and neighboring rights get extended, but we also see culture and society and markets pushing back. We see strong social sharing practices. We see both social action and political mobilization in Creative Commons. It's wonderful to see all these things here, iCommons, the student free culture movement, and even now in the last couple of years, increasingly the emergence of the A to K movement, the access to knowledge movement, as a global coherent idea behind all of these demands for justice and freedom and development in the teeth of the possibilities. Should we be optimistic about this political battle? Well, one maybe waggish way of putting it is I looked at the Grokster briefs, a Supreme Court case in the United States. Who was against Grokster? All the usual suspects you'd expect, motion picture industry, recording industry, etc. Software publishers, Business Software Alliance. Who was for Grokster? Interesting coalition of civil society, Free Software Foundation, left-leaning consumer groups, right-wing conservative NGOs, but radically interesting, AT&T, Bell South, MCI, SBC, Verizon, Consumer Electronics Association, Computer and Communications Industry Association, Intel, Sun Microsystems, etc. So, companies that begin to see that regulating technology and regulating the emerging networked information environment so as to preserve the industrial models is bad for them. How important are these industries? Well, this is how they stack up in revenues from the 2002 consensus. I'm enough of a cynic about politics to think that those who dwarf have a strong chance of winning. But I'm not only a cynic. A couple of years ago, an idea was thrown around about using merry-go-rounds, carousels, in African villages as pumps to pump water. And as the kids were playing around, the water would be pumped and potentially purified. There is enormous potential in what it is that we do as human beings for fun, what we do as human beings to be sociable with each other. It has enormous productive force. We're at a moment technologically where we have the capacity to for greater individual human agency. We can do more, and we're using it to do more socially. This is creating a new set of economic forces and a new set of opportunities to be free and equal human beings. When efficiency and expediency are married to fun and moral demands for freedom and justice, I think there's hope. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Yochai, for another great presentation. And before we open up to all the questions that I know you've been saving up, I just wanted to give Yochai and Hal a chance if they wanted to say anything to in response to the previous talks. You will have an opportunity, of course, to do that later on. I don't know where there's a mic. There must be a mic somewhere. No.
Oh, let's go.
Well, okay, there's a mic that Volker has. And maybe if you could turn the lights down a little bit here and up a little bit there, then we can actually see who is asking questions or see something, because I'm pretty blind here and hot.
Oh, this is awesome.
Okay.
Hi, I have a question to Mr. Benkler concerning one of the last things you said. It must be pretty interesting for most of us to see that the computer industry who was in favor for peer production and free software and et cetera is economically so potent and so mighty, maybe, and so big. Why are they not being heard, or why do they not make themselves heard in the public discussion about exactly this subject? Because they could be like a big, big argument exactly for the subjects that we are discussing here in a very small circle.
This has been a great puzzle to me for several years now. One reason that I constructed this slide is when I do talk to people from these industries, it's to hammer on their heads that they ought to use their money and power in the right way. To some extent, it's not true that they're completely out of this. I mean, you do see them intervening a little bit now in the Grokster issue. I think there's a few things. I think there's a very strong, I'll take that back. I'll speak now from the American perspective, which is really the only one that I know in terms of companies that I've spoken to. Silicon Valley seems to have a very strong cultural bias in believing that whatever is done in Washington, ultimately, they can build around. And so the idea of intervening in the political process is deeply culturally uncomfortable. Even Microsoft, I think, opened their lobbying office for the first time in 2002, give or take. So on the other hand, Hollywood and the recording industry are heavily dependent on the set of laws that they participate in producing, basically copyright and its neighboring rights. So they are highly optimized to negotiate and pressure and stress that particular set of issues. When they do come directly in conflict with another industry that is equally dependent on regulation like telecoms, you see things like we got in the DMCA, where the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US, where on one hand you had enormously broad powers, on the other hand what the carriers wanted, the exemption for carrier, that they could get in because they too were heavily regulated. They just didn't have the imagination to realize that that wasn't enough for the businesses that they were going, and so they got too narrow an exemption for themselves, and the clash continues, and they find themselves on that side in Grokster. But I think it really has to do deeply with the culture of the ones that are on our side, or ought to be on our side, as being a lot less dependent on regulation historically, and therefore a lot less adept at participating.
Let me offer a slightly more economic argument there, and because I do think the historical forces are important, but I would argue this is really an example of the systems competition that I mentioned earlier, that if you sell hardware, you want there to be cheap software. If you sell software, you want there to be cheap hardware, because the value to the user depends on the entire system. If you're selling a complementary product, you want your complementers, the product that's complementary to your own, to be as cheap as possible. If you were selling left shoes, you'd like there to be cheap right shoes and vice versa. So if you're in the business of selling hardware and software that manipulates and communicates information, you want there to be cheap information, right? It's very natural from a business point of view, you want your complementer's price to be as low as possible. So the industries that are lined up on the right-hand side of your column were basically industries who are in the business of communicating and manipulating information. They want there to be cheap information. So from an economic point of view, I think it's perfectly logical.
And there's also a fairly simple reason, I think. I think threats are a bigger focus and motivator than opportunities. And you see this also in the very peculiar reaction of the U.S. diplomatic service in many global forums, whether it is when the U.S. ambassador went and bullied the president of Peru to act against a bill that was being proposed in the Peruvian Congress a few years ago supporting free software, to when the U.S. Basically told WIPO, after WIPO decided to have a discussion on open access and open source, that open source was not within WIPO's remit, they did this following Microsoft's lobbying. And you might wonder why Microsoft and the proprietary software position should be aligned to the US position, because all the big free software companies are American too. It's just that Microsoft sees free software as a threat and is therefore very focused about lobbying for this, whereas IBM, Sun is the only one that actually does something, but IBM and others, to them, they make a lot of money from free software. It's a big opportunity, but it's not that important to make them lobby hard. And it's the same thing with Hollywood. Hollywood sees this as a threat, perhaps, which is enough of a motivator to crack down on everybody. The ones who have the opportunity, it's not something that threatens them. Maybe they'll find other opportunities. So they aren't as strong about it.
Yes, hi. Would you think that peer production will lead to a new form of company, possibly one that eBay, as you mentioned, which Mr. Varian said was different, or Google should have to fear in the future, so that people who collaborate will make new companies using that new production model, whereas an entrepreneur as Google or eBay can't commoditize on. They'll distribute the money they make between themselves. It's, you could say, a form of, in a way, it's a communist idea, but that they keep the resources to themselves and more people could be employed in the company. And they don't have that restraint of having to, you know, pass on the money to a shareholder.
Yeah, I would say there's many interesting possibilities in that area, because if you can be a meeting place, a central point of contact that coordinates buyers and sellers of information, of content, of services, that puts you in a very strong position. So there are lots of companies who would like to be in that in the same position as eBay. Recently, Yahoo has been providing this answer service where they're trying to provide peer expertise, and they've been quite successful at it. It's attracted a lot of attention. They aren't really paying people to answer questions. They certainly aren't paying people to ask questions, but they're trying to get people together who have questions and who have answers. So it's a nice... it's a nice business. A lot of companies will try to capture that point of control.
I understood your question a little differently, so I'll give another. I thought you were asking. I think you're asking about the possibility of cooperatives. You're asking about something equivalent to user-owned firms. And here it's interesting. I mean, one of the question is, what is the residual remaining role of the firm in that situation? And to what extent the firm is something that really stands apart from the competitor, as it were, being simply individuals finding ways to keep body and soul together by participating in a network whose sum is the product of social production. So, for example, Hal spoke earlier about AdSense and what it's done for blogging, or if you didn't say it, you actually had it on your slide. There's a context, and the reason that I'm pushing back on this is because this business of communism keeps being brought up. And I think one needs to understand that communism is as much a product, I'll take that back. Communism as practiced in the world of the 20th century is as much a product of industrial economy as capitalism. Both of them end up having to solve problems through concentration and organization. which is where statism comes and undermines the whole basic idea. Whether what you will need is a co-op or whether what you get is essentially decentralized action. I mean, one of the things that's interesting in the next to last slide is that when you look at software services in the United States, it is about half split. Half of software services is firms, and half is individual contractors. Each of these is bigger than the entire software publishing industry. Okay, so that's not a co-op and it's not communism. It's individual entrepreneurship within social networks. That's one model. Co-ops, I don't know. MySQL is interesting, or at least was for a while, in terms of how being a contributor then leads to becoming an employee and what the relations there are. I don't know enough to study whether co-ops will or won't emerge. Whether they compete with firms that do this will depend on whether they do whatever it is that makes a firm better than just a distributed set of individuals who also make money but also cooperate, rather than on the fact that they're owned, I think, by the individuals or not, in terms of the residual.
Let me say one more word on the way I interpreted the question. I'm not sure we're interpreting it the same way, but that's this idea of a meeting place again. And the two nice recent examples would be MySpace and YouTube, where you look at what they're doing. Any other technology player could do that. I mean, it could have been done by Google, it could have been done by Microsoft, it could have been done by Yahoo, or anybody else who had the infrastructure to create video servers groupware sorts of software. But it happened that those two became the most successful. So being in that position of a meeting place is a very powerful position, and the question, the interesting economic question now, is can they actually monetize it? Because neither of those companies makes a profit for anybody at this point. And would the position that they are in allow them to actually create some sort of profit for shareholders? Well, that remains to be seen. I don't know.
That's a nice example, MySpace in particular, because it was just brought up in an earlier session that MySpace is now getting a huge amount of advertising revenue. But and if anything, they might make money out of advertising, but none of that is going to the people who are actually producing the content. But the people who are producing the content are quite happy to go along producing the content, even if someone else makes money off it. And I think that's something that is essential in this, that these people who are not being motivated by making money out of their contribution, otherwise they would be doing it a bit differently. But also I think it's important not to try to bring too many parallels to communism, because there is no real egalitarian spirit here. There's egalitarianism of opportunity. Everyone has the equal ability or equal opportunity to control and do things if they want to. But that's not what actually happens. If you look at the distribution of contribution of free software code, contribution of Wikipedia editors or Wikipedia entries, and I'm sure if you look at contribution of YouTube videos, you find enormously concentrated distributions where a very small percentage of people do most of the work, and the people who do most of the work naturally have most of the power and get most of the reputation. Sometimes you end up with situations like MySQL or TrollTech or various companies that have formed in the free software space, where those who are doing most of the work do so much of the work that they can assume or pretend that they do all the work and form a company. And in practice, they are doing almost all the work because they hire whoever is doing other things or replace whatever they're doing. So that is a company that is working on the behalf of the producers. It's not working as a producer-consumer collective, because you form a company in order to differentiate yourself from the consumer. If you don't want to differentiate yourself from the consumer, why would you form a company? Or why would you form a cooperative? I mean, even if you look at traditional cooperatives in agriculture, they are formed because they're consumers outside the cooperative.
But I think, Risha, what you just said actually defines not so much what we know as what we need to find out, which is to say we spent a decade, give or take, coming to believe that this is real. And I think we've come to believe that this is real. And I think the next step of issues is trying to understand it at the micro detail how to make it work. And I think, for example, there's a little bit more of a problem than you suggest when you have interface with monetizing organizations, which is the point you were making about ODP. Because on one hand, we have the very clear existence proof again of free software, where some companies are making a lot of money, and yet they aren't seen as leeches. They're seen as in an affirmative reciprocal relationship with the community at large. And so that interface needs to be studied. There are some ham-handed effects. I think there's potential real conflict between when certain efforts get billed as this is something that's done for pay, and others are this is just play, and that the one of the hard questions is how to structure it so that those who are inside the monetizing firm are seen as giving back enough to the community and leaving enough of the respect on the table so that the community continues to thrive rather than the goose that lays the golden eggs gets killed.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, and I think it's also important to focus on the dark side of the force, because if you take each of these examples... I'm saying because you raised the issue, and I think it's the issue I want to follow up on, that if you take each of these business models that sustained let's say the production of content. There's also a dark side. At Google, for example, AdSense has created a model for individual producers of content, but it's also created a huge amount of spam of people who've tried to create pages which are junk. They're nothing but vehicles for advertising. We call them made for AdSense pages because somebody's shown here's a way to realize money from creating content, whether it's useful, valuable content that people really want to have access, or whether it's just some piece that's pulled together from little scraps of content and made available on the web. And spam email, of course, is another example. Spam, amazingly enough, is effective. There is a very interesting paper I just read a few days ago about stock tips. Everybody's getting these stock tips in their email, and by gosh, what happens is some people actually buy the stock, and you can see the price go up from these spam email messages. So it's remarkable that for every step or two steps forward, there's a step behind, and it's a constant struggle to try to keep the message in the medium as opposed to having it diluted by other forces.
All right. I just wanted to ask about privacy. It's right here. And I know Hal has done some work on the economics of privacy, and I would like to ask about privacy as a disutility. So what happens to Rishab's cooking pot when privacy becomes a disutility for the people who are contributing to the pot? I think Yashe has kind of mentioned it. I think FreedomNet is basically about anonymity offered through peer networks, which is also about privacy. I think that success story in that sense about the voting machines is also about privacy. So I'd like to know if your models deal with privacy and with the disutility caused through privacy threats. Thank you.
I'll pass it off.
Privacy is a complicated concept. So let me say just a couple of things. Absolutely, you're right. Where are you? I just can't see with these lights. I don't even know which direction. It would be very embarrassing if I spoke in that direction and it turned out you were sitting there. I can see. Now I can see. Exactly. There is a lot of experimental economics work that gives strong evidence that cooperation is best sustained when people can identify each other. This is because, for a variety of reasons, the most mundane is you can actually monitor people, and when people are defecting and taking advantage of the group, they can be punished by the group. But it's also because it's part of humanization, and people tend to cooperate when they know that on the other side, when they have a sense of the human being on the other side, as opposed to just a mechanical nothing on the other side of a transaction in a prisoner's dilemma or whatever it is. And so anonymity is bad for cooperation, except that it turns out from our actual experience that persistent pseudonymity works almost as well, particularly when it's attached to at least partial revelation on talk pages in Wikipedia or elsewhere of what it is that makes that person behind the pseudonym a person, a human being, as opposed to just someone there, or not someone, just an other. And so the concern we have with privacy, to the extent that it's implemented with concerns about sticky reputation, pseudonymity, is a real tension. I think, though, that when we are concerned about privacy, what we're worried about is autonomy, oppression, the ability to take from us the power to segment our lives into different social spheres and different spheres of action, which is why it was important for me to focus on the possibility of persistent pseudonymity that is context-specific as a potential solution to the cooperation problem, while maintaining what I perceive to be the core question of privacy, which is one of self-possession and self-control and the ability to segment our social interactions. So that here, we're this handle, and we have to be persistently that if we're going to be cooperators. But over there, we can be another handle, each of which will be separate from who we are. And so there's tension. I don't think it's tension all the way down.
Yeah. About 12 years ago, I wrote a little article about selling privacy as a commodity, and in effect, what you're getting is a lot of that in all these advertising-based things, because essentially people are giving up their privacy in exchange for some value. But when you look at cooperative activities, it is pretty important for people in collaborative activities to give up some of their privacy, or rather some of their anonymity. And exactly as Yochai says, what happens is you have to develop identities that build up trust within a specific community if you want to contribute. You can't make an anonymous contribution to a free software project. That does not necessarily mean, and even if you look at things like Wikipedia, where you can anonymously contribute, there are all sorts of places where there are little barriers put up, and even those who are anonymously contributing are logged by their IP address and so on. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that you can't build up identities within communities that are completely independent of what your identity in another situation is. I mean, I remember that there was a case in a particular programming community that there was someone who would always appear to be a woman, and in fact, it turned out to be a man, but everyone still referred to him by his female name, and it was just not a big deal because it was a particular context. He had an identity in that context, and that's how it is. So it's perfectly possible, because these collaborative communities are collaborating around a specific activity. You're collaborating about a particular project, or whether it's AT at Home or Wikipedia or whatever, and you might have a completely different identity in another area, so that doesn't really matter. So then it really is a question, I think, about what you think of as privacy. In a lot of the empirical research that I do on free software production, we've had a lot of ethical issues, especially since we are EU-funded, about the privacy implications. In principle, we aren't violating anyone's privacy since the data we are using is all public. We are using things like all the data that's out on version control software, people's posts to mailing lists, public mailing lists, which are well documented. But using that, we can tell a lot about what people are doing in terms of their output, in terms of how much time they spend, in terms of whether they are good programmers or not. And you could imagine people have concerns about that. But the concerns are obviously not enough for people to, in practice, take measures against it. So whoever wants to ask questions has to grab the mic.
Okay, no, just a second. I just wanted to kind of sharpen the question. And namely, in this kind of upcoming technologies, I think the possibility of opting out of giving your identity is going to be more and more difficult. As we know from cell phones, we're quite easily identified. So I see privacy becoming a bigger concern. I don't know if you agree. And I know Hal has done some work on this. Basically, economics depends on perfect information. And right now, there's a market failure, if you want to call it that way, because there isn't enough information about the customers. And Web 2.0 is partially a hype because you can kind of move towards perfect information and ideas with the Internet of Things and RFID chips that you can follow more and know more about your customers. So I think there's an economic interest in violating privacy, and there's also a disutility which should maybe balance out.
Well, I guess I have a somewhat controversial view that I think most people don't care very much about privacy. And I just base this on how they behave. There's anecdote after anecdote. There are plenty of cases where people give up quite a bit of privacy for relatively low cost, whether that's supermarket scanner cards or all loyalty clubs or discount cards in supermarkets. Basically, people don't care very much about it. And typically, I would say businesses want to know things about your behavior primarily so they can compete more effectively. I don't think that most businesses care what you buy or what you shop, except to the extent that they can compete more effectively for your trade. So privacy, in my opinion, is really somewhat overblown because most people don't really care. That's been my experience. I could be wrong. I know some people care passionately, but in general, it's not such a big issue for most consumers.
Yeah, and I think businesses probably are not really, I'm sure all of you care passionately about your privacy, but businesses are not that interested in the small group of people who care about their privacy. I mean, they're only too happy to deal with the large market of people who don't care. And the fact is that the majority don't care. I mean, I remember it's even people you don't expect. I used to be part of the cypherpunks group in the early 90s, and one of the major posters would always talk about these, you know, he's the guy who posted the famous, it used to be very famous at that time, Blacknet, all about the theoretical concept of a cryptographically secure anonymous network where you could trade in illegal things completely untraceably. But he would always send his mails in plain text because it was too much trouble to encrypt it.
I'm standing here, and I'd like to ask you, Hi Benkler, about the lemmings. There's some kind of an echo. Sorry. So what I'm thinking is that the group of people who are producers are a very small group. There's not a problem with them supplying enough content. As you say, Wikipedia grows enormously in 5 years. But still, when you look at the whole population of humans, they're a very tiny group, and you can maybe put aside the people where there are still issues of access and so on. But then we have people who have the means, but don't produce content. When in democracy, when you think about voting, when people have the means to vote, but don't vote, at some point you'd start talking about the crisis. And so do you think there's a problem, a similar parallel problem with production when not enough people produce content?
Well, you've put your finger on why it is that I am reluctant to simply adopt the utopia of everyone a pamphleteer. Because, as you say, as it turns out, it's only several million people, as opposed to several hundred million, who are posting. Why am I nonetheless optimistic? Or not optimistic? Why do I nonetheless see this as a dramatic change in the construction of the public sphere, even though it is not universally adopted? There are, if you accept that the basic industrial structure of mass media has been in place for 150 years, then effectively you accept that, except for maybe the early American Republic, the early Dutch Republic, a few years in the French Republic, somewhat British parliamentary system. Anyway, except for a very small number of examples, some of them for a very short period, certainly all modern complex democracies have developed in the context of mass media, either state-owned or commercial or some mixture. And when you're moving from a world with one outlet, three outlets, 17 outlets, pick a number, with 3,000, 5,000, 20,000 members of an elite capable of accessing them, to a universe with millions of people, whether or not affiliated with a particular organization, because even when you're talking about, say, 20,000, they're still probably clumped in between 5 and 20 organizations, roughly, depending on how competitive. That's the fundamental change, because even if you don't produce, you are one or two steps removed at most from somebody who does. So it changes the habits of it. As you go through the world and you see something, in a mass media environment, you put it in your back pocket, and then maybe sometime at a party, you talk about it. But it doesn't become for you something you could imagine, I can do something about that. To the extent that what we're doing is we're extrapolating from a very early version of a direction that we're going to. And, you know, in the U.S., the Pew Trust did a study a couple of months ago that said that something like 54% of bloggers are below age 30. So there's a cohort effect in terms of generational shift. There might also be an age effect, which would dampen it. But in any event, I think what we're seeing is, A, the number is growing and the practices are growing. And B, the phase shift from some small number of organizations and small number of thousands of participants to millions of participants, whether or not organized, that's the critical change. If you're talking 20 million people or 100 million people, that's less of a change. And so that's why I said it's not a utopia, but it is a very big change.
Yeah, and I think you can actually treat it as very democratic. It might not be everyone a pamphleteer, but it is pretty much every opinion a pamphlet, in the sense that it's like one voice, one vote. Whoever wants to say something can. And the fact that not many people actually say something may either mean that they share the opinions of some of those expressing them, or it may be a generational issue, or it may be our own assumptions. I mean, we are biased when we look at this. We look at some fraction of expression and say that that is important expression. But there's all the crap on MySpace and where people are expressing themselves. And that's what they want to say, so that's just fine. And the point is they can. And if you look at it also in generational terms, in France, 60% of every teenager with internet access has his or her own blog. So maybe nobody reads the blog, but they have a blog. And that's already enormous penetration. That's 60% of the entire internet population. So I think that pretty soon we'll find that pretty much anyone who wants to say something says it. Whether anyone else listens is a different matter. So Larry is going to talk tomorrow about the Read-Write Society. I wonder whether it will be mainly a write-only society.
Well, actually, I mean, that is absolutely critical because the main critiques of the claims that the internet democratizes have taken the form of concern with fragmentation in the first generation, or the first round of interpretations of the graph theory studies of link structure on the web and the blogosphere, which of course is highly skew, if not exactly power law. It is actually in the whole, when you look at very broad at the web or at the blogosphere generally. And then the concern is, okay, everybody is again just reading one or two or five people. It's the fact that everybody can talk doesn't matter if nobody hears. But this is actually something that when I telegraphed, we have some empirical data. I was trying to telegraph something that I spend about 20 pages on in the book, of actually trying to interpret what do we know from the empirical studies in graph theory on link structure, either at the web, at the web level of the web generally, or the blogosphere particularly, or the political blogosphere even. And I think what we're seeing there is a number of important phenomena. It's not pure power law all the way down. First of all, there's clustering. You won't be surprised to hear that a political blog is more likely to link to a political blog than to a website advertising laundry detergent. The other thing that's very important is that as you get to smaller and smaller clusters, but still at the level of hundreds or even low thousands of sites, you're no longer in a pure power law. You've got a little bit of a droopy head on a log-log distribution, which basically means you do have one or two major superstars that everybody reads, but you can have tens or even hundreds of sites that will have tens of links, which means it's not there's two that everybody sees and millions that nobody sees. It means that there are millions that tens or hundreds of people see. And the structure actually is self-similar as you go from very small clusters to regional networks. So what you essentially get is instead of everybody listening to one, I'll take that back. Everything I'm saying now is interpretation of work of other people that I've not done. Take it with the appropriate grains of salt. Now that I haven't done the empirical work, I've done the interpretation. What you actually, I think, are seeing, or what we're observing, is that through linking behavior in relatively small clusters, but again, when I say small, it's not three people, it's hundreds of sites, communities of interest that cluster and link to each other because they care about the same set of issues talk. And then suddenly the people who care about the same set of issues say, this story, this blog post, this website, that's important, and it begins to rise. And then it gets seen by one of these major long-tail sites and gets linked to. These are already big enough so that they're seen at the regional level, if you want to use the metaphor of thinking of it a region. And then the power law structure, given how it clusters in small clusters, becomes an attention backbone where information can actually be filtered by communities of interest and then absorbed into the general public sphere. That's what I mean when I say that we have an inversion of agenda setting from something that the mass media decide to market to millions of people in a way that won't offend them too much so as to attract them, to something that groups of people who are intensely interested in a particular subject, enough so as to cluster into a group, think this is important. And that's very different. And given that if it's true that agenda setting is coming from people who care enough to read, even if they don't post, on a particular set of issues, as opposed to from mass media that try to serve an average viewer, then that is a quite significant change in the way agendas get set and statements get set and expressions get perceived as important for the public sphere.
Actually, let me say a word on that, because I mostly look at economics blogs and occasionally political blogs, and my impression, just my own casual empiricism, is about three-fourths of the economics postings start with an article from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the Economist. So it's not so much, in my opinion, that blogs offer a way to talk, but they offer a way to talk back. In many cases, it's a reaction to the mass media, even though sometimes in a reaction of approval, sometimes a reaction of disagreement, but it's the conversation that's critical, not so much the dissemination of information, but the back path to the popular media.
That's an interesting. There's an interesting discussion I'm in with Henry Jenkins at MIT, who does a lot of work on fan culture, on whether or not fan culture is completely dependent on mass media. This is now not on the Times and the Economist and the Economist, but on the kids. My intuition is, and here again, I'm departing even further from the empirics. My intuition is that nothing just sort of happens ex nihilo. And the entire set of cultural practices of the 20th century is centered on mass media, be it for purposes of visual art or video, or be it for purposes of news. And so all culture is conversation with existing culture, and of necessity that plays a large role. The question is the degree to which the generativity comes from both sides. And what you're seeing now is simply the weightedness of the fact that this occupies so much of our cultural space already. And is there a path of trajectory towards something that's more mixed? And my sense is that yes.
Let me loop back to what you said at the beginning, the story about the newspapers, because I think that was a very important observation. I think the change in newspapers between the 200 years ago and today was driven by two features. One, technology that lowered the cost of production. So instead of distributing a few newspapers to some gentlemen's clubs and wealthy people and small circles of elite, you could actually, it was cost effective to distribute to a large audience. But the second thing was the rise of advertising. I mean, the reason that mass media is mass is because of advertising. That's what drives television, that's what drives radio, that's what drives most of print. And now, of course, this is what's driving a lot of the production of content on the internet. So the 20th century is unique, I think, because you've got this incredible rise of this business model, which played a very, very small role historically, but it's a completely dominant role in today's culture. And is it good? Is it not a good thing? I mean, you can debate this endlessly, and I think, of course, there's both a good and bad aspect to it. The fact that you have advertising helps support dissemination of information. It also distorts it in various ways. And I'm sure the debate will continue on into the next century as well.
I think I see the mic there on the left.
I think I have the privilege of the last question, if I... Yeah. Okay, I'm here on the right side.
Okay, I saw someone waving there, but I can't really see anything, so whoever...
It's okay.
Okay.
I'm researching in my PhD the effects of software patenting on open source innovation, and from that angle my question comes. Yochai and Rishab, you've mentioned in your presentations the growing importance or the success of the open source free software movement over the last years. And in one of the questions like 10 minutes ago, we've been discussing how the flow in of money by firms might change the incentive structure of the FLOSS developers and actually perhaps just draw out developers, and this might harm the further development. So I consider this to be one of the threats for the open source movement in the future. Then there's another threat, which was also mentioned by Yoka in the presentation, intellectual property, the regime with software patents and increasing length of duration of copyright, etc. So my question to you is, which of these two threats you would consider the bigger threat in the future? Do we have to expect more danger or harm from any further software patent discussion or regulation in the EU or even in the US? or do you think the bigger danger for the further development of open source might actually be its success, that money comes in, developers are hired away, and the intrinsic motivation might just fade out or die?
Well, although you have a few cases of some star free software developers being hired away to proprietary software development, in general, free software developers are hired by companies that want them to do free software. So, and even back in 99, it's not that money is new to free software. Even back in 99, most of the kernel developers I talked to were completely incredulous at the thought that they could be starving. They all made quite a lot of money. Whether at that time it was more through freelance consultancy, now it's working for, you know, companies like IBM, which I believe spends about $170 million just on Linux development a year. So you have very little, I think, of stealing away from free software to proprietary software, except perhaps in developing countries. In India, one reason for the participation, relatively low participation of free software developers in India compared to the number of programmers that are there, might well be that if you've got the opportunity to earn 10 or 20 times what your parents earned, or write free software, what are you going to do? So that's the opportunity cost in developing countries is much, much higher. Similarly, the reason why Germany is one of the world leaders in terms of free software development is that, well, Germany just happens to have one of the world's largest, longest student lives. So you have a lot of people with a lot of time, and the opportunity cost is very low. So that's something that you find that, and that's also something that you find as people, and then it really depends how much into free software do they get, so that after that, when they are paid, do they go to proprietary or free software? And that's where I think the commercialization is actually a good thing, because 5 or 10 years ago, free software developers would do a lot of free software while they were students. Then when they get married and have children, and we actually track that in our surveys, they either earn a lot of money doing free software or they are doing proprietary software. So now you have the potential to, much more potential to earn a lot of money doing free software, which means that many more people will continue to do free software. So I think that's not a threat at all. Patents are a problem, but I don't want to go into that.
Well, let me say a quick word about software patents. I could talk about them all night, but I want to make the provocative claim that the software industry as a whole would like to see software patents go away. Microsoft, IBM, Google, Yahoo, they're a huge pain. They would like to get rid of software patents, but there's no easy way to do it. You said, how can that be? Because each of those companies, Microsoft, IBM, Google, Yahoo, everybody else, is patenting things like crazy. Well, it's exactly the same dynamic as the Cold War. U.S. had missiles pointing at Russia. Russia had missiles pointing at the U.S. Everybody would have been happy with disarmament, but it's very, very hard to do because you don't want unilateral disarmament. And it's exactly the same with the software industry. By and large, the software industry does not want software patents. But given that the other guy has software patents, they've got to have them as a defensive measure. And the challenge is, how can you disarm this very unpleasant situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have that much to add, I think, to both of these. So I would defer, since I've spoken a lot already.
Okay. Hello, I have an economic question. So long as the commons and the commons-based peer production does not include real physical property, such as land and non-commodity capital, can it make a real difference in general wealth, or will the actual marginal increase in wealth be captured by owners of real property by way of rents and interest?
I think to the extent we understand ourselves as being in an information economy, a global information economy, It's the critical point is precisely that the people who control the information capture the value. That's the complaint. When you look at the global trade system, that in some sense the people who control the IP rights, the people who control the trademarks, end up being able to extract the value, as opposed to the people who own the physical capital. I see that you want to that you want either to clarify or criticize. So we should. I don't know whether you have the mic on you.
Isn't intellectual property largely owned by people who previously owned real property, such as land and non-commodity capital?
No. I mean, this is fact that makes the Creative Commons movement possible, the fact that makes GPL work.
But those people still have to pay rents for their apartment, for instance.
Those
people still have to pay rents for their apartment, for instance. If marginal wealth was increased as a result of the commons-based peer production around the information economy, what's to stop rents on land from simply absorbing that? Because you'd have more wealth competing for the same number of locations, so the fixed supply of land would still capture all the rent.
You just saw the exchange here about all of the set of whether or not services and human services and specificity is something that people are willing to pay rents for. What Howe was describing as the series of mechanisms by which you generate rents not from land.
But wouldn't those captured rents still flow through to land by competing for locations and driving up rent property?
Sorry. I think it's a profound question. What is the source of scarcity? And you were suggesting land as a fundamental source of scarcity, and in some places that's true. I live in California. I should know that land values are ridiculously high in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. But the real source, and this may be trite, but the real source is the scarcity of attention. You have so many demands on your time and so many channels on TV and so many books to read and so many programs to write that the challenge that most of us face is how to allocate our time. Now, it's true, maybe in Germany everybody's a student and they just sit in the cafes, but actually even when you're sitting in the cafe, you have to decide what it is that you want to devote your attention to. And I think that's the dilemma of modern life is... Where do you devote your attention? Yeah, and that's what everybody's competing for. That's what all these information industries are trying to capture, your attention.
I think the reason we talk of an information economy is that fixed capital goods are much less valuable relative to other goods. I mean, there was a time when we spent most of our income on food. When we had more income, the prices of food didn't continue to go up. I mean, and now agriculture is 3% of OECD countries' economies and industry is also declining as a share of economy. So it's just a question of what people value in relative terms. If people don't value land as much as they value, well, attending Wizards of Oz, then land prices will be cheaper than the opportunity cost of attending Wizards of Oz. So I think I wouldn't agree that's going to be a problem. I mean,
Well, I didn't have to worry about what to do. People didn't have to worry about what to do 100 years ago. They had to farm. They had to cut wood. They had to do all of these things merely to survive. Nowadays, we have comparatively so much leisure time and so many demands on our attention of how to spend that leisure time, how to spend that discretionary time. That's the new economy.
Okay. I think that was the last question, and we are already half an hour late. And it's really great that all of you stayed awake. Hal and Yochai are both on another time zone, so they should be awake anyway, especially Yochai, who's going to spend 20 hours in Berlin, and he's going straight back in a couple of hours now. So I'd like to thank Yochai and Hal for a wonderful set of presentations here and a great discussion, and thank Volker and the organizers for inviting us all here, and all of you for being such a great audience and having such a participatory discussion. Thank you.